and that those blockages came from two sources. One is the cost benefit, which Norbert has mentioned, and the other was objections on principle or technical objections. And so as we work through the value chain of standard preparation, we looked at those in sequence. And at the outset, at the research stage, we felt it essential to bridge the gap, the expectation gap, between the users and the preparers. We felt that a clear articulation of the user needs and exactly what problem is being solved by a piece of work was critical at the outset, at the research stage, and that those clear statements would need to be made public so that everybody knows where we're going and why we're going there. The second element of the value chain, the agenda decision, obviously needs to refer to those clear reasonings supported by the user needs, but should also, in our view, contain a cost benefit. Now, we understand that until a standard is developed, the actual implementation costs may not be fully clear. But we believe that some statement of benefit should at least be feasible, and that the agenda decision should be a clear point in the value chain where the reasoning, the statement of user needs, and the outline cost-benefit analysis is put on the table. Now, moving through to the process of developing and then endorsing standards, we thought it critical to maintain the preparer involvement in the dialogue through that whole discussion process, leveraging those working groups. And there, the representative nature of preparer involvement is going to be critical. We would reiterate the cost-benefit equation at the point that the exposure draft is published, and at which point some proposals are clearly on the table for implementation. And we would ensure that the contrary views of principle expressed by different preparers, different constituencies, were included in the basis for conclusions, and thereby we could be seen to have an honest and an open process of decision making at the board level on those technical and principle issues. So our strategy then is to get the cost-benefit equation on the table as early as possible in the process and have a clear articulation of user needs and the different alternative technical arguments. On the fifth question, we felt there's a low risk of any of these points impinging upon the independence of the board. We felt there is a good broad section of coverage out there, and so we had a low risk on that. I don't know if any of the group have points to add.
Great, thanks, Will. All right, group three, Bruce.
Thank you very much. Group three also had quite a lively debate in terms of what we felt. Some of the points have been expressed before, I won't harp on them, but we also had some points of difference. On the first one, in terms of what groups the ISB should engage with, we felt this had to be very much purpose-driven. So the idea was, what are we looking at, what outreach needs to be performed, and then from there make a decision. So if you're looking at a stand on extractive industries, we'd reach out to the countries where extractive industries was a big issue. If it was oil and gas, reach out to people in those areas. So very much purpose-driven. The one thing we did feel, though, and I guess maybe this is a slight departure from where Will's group was in terms of the practical expedient, was we felt that starting off on a geographical basis is probably the best way of doing it. Reason being, there currently in many of the regions structures in place that already exist in terms of regional bodies. Also, practically, getting people together would be a lot easier to do on a practical basis. And once you develop those groups and got hold of those groups, then we could stratify them into, obviously, what industry are we looking at, what is their function, user, preparer, auditor, and try and get details from them there. The other thing we also felt was quite important was obviously the list of organizations I can appreciate is growing, and I can imagine the ISB getting a longer and longer list every day. So we felt what could be quite useful is to use regional committees to a degree filter. So instead of having a table much like this where you've got 50 people all wanting to give their view and all the ISB do is listen, rather get that filtered. Use the regional committees, use it whatever you can, so that when the ISB does engage with these regional committees, it's a smaller group representing the views of people in those regions, and it'll be a lot easier to dialogue as opposed to just having to listen. On the second one, the question obviously in terms of how they should do it, well, we felt that was very much case to case. And you'd have to look at it, all the shareholders differ, and that would be, you know, depend on what the nature of what you're looking at. Very importantly, though, that and I think this was echoed before, is we do believe that there needs to be a lot more involvement on the research. We felt that, I guess, the one challenge was we wanted to, for want of a better word, front load a lot of the work and make sure that there's been engagement from day one. I think if we leave this engagement through to the end, that's where the challenges are coming in, is at the 11th hour people are saying this doesn't work. Rather get that all up front. It'll be a lot easier. In addition, we felt that the frequency of engagements were a lot more, once again, of using those regional bodies. Get on out, use the various national standard setters to develop groups, to put them together, to try and get feedback. And then that feedback is distilled into something that's quite a bit more important, as opposed to just everybody giving a comment. The third one, I think much like the other groups, probably the third and fourth started quite a bit of debate around endorsement, and I think we spent quite a bit of time on this. Look, I think that the message we came to was that there's always going to be a risk of non-endorsement. And I think we debated the models that various countries have gone, and if I take the two the extremes, we had, I mentioned South Africa on the one side, where South Africa's decision was to adopt IFRS as is. So the moment the ISB issues a standard, it is immediately becomes law in South Africa. The reason we'd taken that decision was we took a decision to be involved in the process, we run our committees, we feedback comment letters, but once it's been issued, it's there. Then we kind of had the middle ground where Paul explained the Canadians more, where yes, there's an endorsement mechanism, but unless there's something really tragic, it's more of a rubber stamp, where obviously within the other side we had the Europeans, where it was very much more of a formal process. And I think we've all seen a potential risk of non-endorsement as that comes along. It was felt, obviously, that as far as due process goes, there should be a lot more field testing before publication of the standards. So the feeling was, the concern was once again, that once the standard has been issued, the danger is it's already out there. And I guess if I take it back to the first example I gave around somewhere like South Africa, in many countries, where the moment you issue the standard, it becomes law for us. If you and I are going to go and change that because now suddenly somebody realizes something happens, it does create problems in those countries. So rather get to a stage where there's a lot more. The other thing that was expressed, and there was debate quite a bit between the group members, was around justifying the decisions as they get made. So as the ISB works through a project, so it's justifying why it's taken directions that it has. And I think the feeling there was just concern, it was the concern that if people were giving their feedback and it wasn't incorporated into the final standard, that they didn't feel that, our feedback hasn't been taken in, but at least that the ISB has considered it, and whether you're right or wrong and we've won, we wouldn't get there. Just in terms of the field tests, one of the suggestions that was made was that the field testing could be a little bit more formalized and controlled by the ISB. What we don't mean is that the team fly around the world to various countries to do it, but maybe the ISB puts together a field testing toolkit, something a bit more detailed and a bit more focused to say, these are the issues, this is what we want to know. Just to give out the standard and say, you know, does this work with a few questions? Well, what are the issues? And really, let's draw on the controversial issues. You know, some of the examples given were things like in IFRS 10. We could have put it out there just saying, what are the issues on SPVs? Are you consolidating? Are you not? You know, so pick the issues that are controversial, do the testing on that, and get focused field testing back as to whether that works or not. As far as the risk of non-endorsement goes, the other thing that we said is you have to rely very, very heavily on due process. And the fact is that once you've done due process, if we all buy into the due process, we have to accept then that is the answer and that you can't be too unhappy with it. I guess we had to keep conscious, obviously, that the one concern about doing outreach was that if organizations are doing outreach, they want to know that it's not going to be done and the results are going to be too late. So if they say, well, we're going to do a major piece of outreach over the next 3 months, they don't want to read at the board meeting a month later that the ISP's now taken a completely different angle and that the outreach programs they're involved in are a waste of time. So that was a bit of concern about that. I guess the other thing to point out very much is that we wanted to stress that the involvement of bodies has to be proactive. We can't sit here and say, well, it's the ISP's responsibility to get on out there and find every user body, find every analyst community, and get them to feedback. That I think it also needs to be accepted that this is a two-way street. In fact, if anything, it's probably a lot more bottom-up driven. If organizations want to be involved and they're wanting their views expressed, they need to get out there, get the views, and get them to the ISP. Yes, as much as the ISP will obviously solicit views, it's very difficult for them to chase every organization across the geographies in which it applies. And I guess the last point on that very much was, well, there's always going to be a risk of people being unhappy, but as long as they can realize that the views they've expressed were considered, and even if they weren't, the standard wasn't changed to suit them, as long as the views had been considered and it's been taken into account, that there's a lot less risk of non-endorsement. I think the biggest risk was if you're going to ignore people's views, and well, at least if they perceive to have ignored people's views, that was a risk that was there. The last one, just in terms of the independence, we obviously believe the independence was key, but I guess our group felt the same, that any risk, any independence risks were probably more perceived than anything else. That the more stakeholder engagement that there was, the better the independence would be perceived to be. I guess the only red flag that was raised was a feeling that potentially at the moment there's a bit more of a we need to converge no matter what, and that some of the other stakeholders felt that, well, if all we're doing is worrying about convergence for the US, well, that are our views really going to be taken into account because we want to converge with the FASB, and if they don't agree with it, then we're going to go that way. So just a little bit of a concern that maybe the independence is perceived to be a little bit more towards the US at the moment than anything else. I'm just seeing if there's anything else. And lastly, just the last question was obviously a bit of a governance issue around the issuance of the standards. If a standard comes out and everybody is unhappy, you know, maybe that's the point at which you need to realize that we didn't get to the right answer. The one thing that was expressed was if a standard has come out and there is now a major implementation challenge, and we may just have missed it or along the way, that there needs to be a mechanism in place to fix that quickly. That to then write in and for that to take too long may not be practical, especially given that it needs to be relooked at, it may need to be reissued, countries may need to bring into law, it may impact effective dates. That if it is something fatal, that it needs to be looked at with quite an expedience. That's what I had. I don't know if anybody else in our group has a comment. Not?
Thanks, Bruce. Any comments from the group? All right, then let's turn to the fourth group. Give the auditors a shot at it.
Yeah, we looked around the room in our group and we thought that maybe there was something we had in common, which probably was we looked at auditors and regulators. So I'll try to get some feedback on that. Patrick and I decided that it's probably not for him to kick me if I say something wrong, because a regulator kicking an auditor is not a good thing. you never know what people are going to think about that. Before I start, on behalf of Group 4, I'd like to first express compliments to the IASB for its huge outreach and consultation activity over the past few years. I mean, so it's not like all we're saying here is things that have gone wrong. It's more like, what can you improve? What can you make more practical? Because one thing is clear, with the growing number of constituents of the IASB, it's simply not possible to talk to everybody about everything all the time. So this is not about doing more. I think this is about getting a bigger bang for your buck. And that's the background with which we started our discussion. So first of all, on question one, I mean, us being auditors and regulators, we wanted to be comprehensive. So we did a check on paragraph 19, whether you've missed anything. And we found two groups that you might want to add to the list of constituents, which is the other international standard setters, and April was very good in all the abbreviations, so I just mentioned a few: the IVSC, the IAASB, the IIRC, the IPSIS board, etc. And maybe also, although we realize that there's also the role of the monitoring board here, but there's also a technical side to the public interest organizations that you might want to get to ask some feedback on your standards on, like the OECD, the UNDP, etc. So the next thing was, how are you going to organize this networking? We thought it was clear from the presentations this morning that the different classes of constituents have organized themselves very differently. I mean, if you look at the auditors, they're probably best approach them on a global level. Accounting standard setters, either regional or global, but for example, preparing users are probably not organized on a regional basis, at least not at the moment. So the question we thought was key is, do you want to create a network, or do you want to tap into an existing network? And tapping into the existing network is probably easier. Creating your own one may be more functional. Also, we thought that it wasn't like one size fits all. It may well be that networking with these constituents may depend on what the phase of the project is you're in, as well as what the topic is. However, having said that, there was a general feeling that at least you should start with the regional standard setters for a couple of reasons. One is they've already organized something at their regional level between the different constituents, that's the easy one to tap into. And also, there is already an existing relationship there. The overriding goal we thought was that everyone should feel connected, and because even if you're not, opinion is not taken over by the ISB at the end, as long as you have the feeling that at least you've made your point and it's heard, but you were just in the minority camp, that should provide enough base for people to go on. So the sign point regional standards at the level, and have them organize regional meetings that would include preparers, users, and others. On question two, which is the format you then would use, is there's of course the periodic regular networking liaison that could be done on the regional level with the regional standard setters. As long as it's inclusive, so that probably means that you need some form of understanding with regional standard setters on their due process in inviting people, making sure people are heard, and be inclusive. That can't be the whole story. You still need targeted outreach, targeted liaison, depending on topic and the phase in the project. So on the topic, you might want to think about the sectors that are involved in the particular project, or the phase in the project. So in the beginning of the project, you probably need more, let's say, conceptual input, whereas later on in the game, you're probably more looking like the practicalities and economic consequences. On format, I mean, it's probably difficult to advise the ISB. That's probably best to be left to the board itself. It's judgmental on how you think you can best get the best feedback. On endorsement and acceptance, as long as you make sure that you at least involve those who are, let's say, involved in that process, and make sure that they are part of the process, we think you got the best chance of getting your standards accepted. That probably starts with regional standard setters, but you may also want to look at others who are either taking those decisions or having a significant influence on those decisions. And on the final question, five, on independence, the biggest message here is be even-handed. So don't raise the impression that one category of constituents is getting more favorable treatment than any other. We then moved into, do you also want, what about regional interpretations or country interpretations? We thought that the regional standard setters may play an important role here. First of all, by channeling that, and second, by making sure they are first brought to the interpretations committee, and also making sure that, because our experience is that there are hardly any country-specific issues that are so specific to be dealt with at the local level. And the last comment made was, in some regions, we have the feeling that part of the constituents are feeling left out or have not organized themselves and therefore might be inclined to feel left out. That may be a matter of time, but maybe the regional standard setter should be encouraged to make sure that they are inclusive, so including preparers and users in their regions. Patrick couldn't kick me, but maybe others of our group want to add anything that I missed.
Any supplemental comments? Carol.
Just two issues that were put on the table in our group that hadn't been mentioned by any other group that I thought might just be worth touching on briefly. We briefly considered what channels for communication could be used in a world where there are multi-channels, and in the context of that we did consider the possible use of social media, and the view was pretty strongly felt that that's a useful tool for the board communicating outwards but would not be particularly useful for receiving meaningful feedback, particularly in the context of being able to have some quality control over that feedback and identifying the source and the motivation. The other issue, which sort of tangential to a point that's been made by every group, namely how to minimise the risk of carve-outs. Clearly, everyone's focused on the due process, maintaining the integrity of the due process and having transparency over that to give comfort to all of the users of IFRS that the process is fair. And in terms of cost-benefit, the focus in all of the presentations strikes me as being very much on an individual standard-by-standard basis. But there is also a cost-benefit way of thinking about full compliance with IFRS as opposed to a carve-out, and that is the logic for any country giving up sovereignty over its standards and outsourcing that to a foreign institution presumably would only occur because there's some perceived benefit. And the benefit obviously is wrapped up in the expectation of high-quality standards, but the high-quality standards are a means to an end. The end must be an enhanced allocation of an efficiency of capital or lower cost of capital. And it's potentially a source, I think, for some interesting research now that there is a sufficiently long enough, I think, history of a number of jurisdictions adopting IFRS to try and do some meaningful research, recognising that it won't be easy to quarantine the use of accounting standards from other factors that would clearly impact on the cost of capital. But in the same way that in a national jurisdiction there is a stick and a carrot, where the stick in a national jurisdiction is you must comply fully with the law, you can't carve out part of the law that you don't like. Obviously that's not practical in the context of the ISB, but there could be a notional stick if there were a more robust and transparent way of identifying and effectively listing or rating countries according to their compliance. So full compliance with IFRS means you're effectively AAA rated. And in the same way that a credit rating has a direct impact on your cost of capital, that sort of approach to adoption of accounting standards might over time also be able to demonstrate, and that would then become the proof that full compliance is better than carve-outs because there is actually a penalty in terms of your cost of capital. So it's just a different thought that was put on the table that hasn't been mentioned by any of the other groups.
Yeah, that's interesting, Charles, and I think eventually that proposition has to be test it in terms of whether the benefit really is there, and it will cut unevenly by jurisdiction because it depends very much on what your starting point was. A wide range of views expressed. Hans, do you want to venture a couple of reactions?
Yes, a wide range of views, but also, again, last, in a last meeting, a lot of consensus. On one hand, it's gratifying to hear that there seems to be a lot of appreciation for the way in which we do our outreach, and it is recognized that we do a lot. At the same time, there is a growing realization that we would probably need to do it better, that we are entering a new era, and that we have to streamline both our networks and we have to streamline our procedures, our way of working. And I indeed think both need to be done. Why are we sort of at an end or of an era, beginning of a new era? I think there are a couple of factors. Very important is that the convergence process with the FESB is coming to an end. That's going to change the way we are going to work with standard setters. The fact that IFRS has spread enormously around the world over the years, which has tremendously increased our web of relations without necessarily a lot of structure in it. And it has also increased the risk of non-endorsement, I think. The wider our use, the use of our standards is, the bigger the chances that one of the jurisdictions will say, we don't like this particular standard, we would like to do something else. And all these risks need to be contained, and we have to prepare our organization to better communicate with all the different actors, preparers, investors, users, regulators. I think we talk with everybody. We certainly do, don't we? We talk with everybody, but do we do it efficiently? I really wonder. One area that we are looking at very closely and concretely now is how to work with the national standard setters and the regional groupings. One thing is for sure, that is that we now have a situation in which three institutions have a sort of a privileged access to the to the ISB, if you want to say it that way. It's the FESB, of course. EFREC has a very close relationship, and then we have twice a year we have a dialogue with the Japanese standard setters, and then we have relations with everybody else through the NSS, through IFES, through world standard setters, and often bilateral contacts. But these are the three groups that have more or less a regular, more formalized access relationship with the IASB. That in the future is, I think, no longer tenable. We have to look for a different solution. We have to have a council or a forum or a platform of standard setters plus regional groups that we can talk to at a regular basis, let's say four times a year, where we can hear how the standard setters are looking at our work, what they think of standards that we're working on, where they can give us signals at a very early stage, and where we can communicate about the direction to take. An advisory function, it should not infringe on the independence of the board, but a close relationship where I would say you would have to meet at least four times a year. It is also clear that this group has to be both inclusive, and yet it also has to be compact. Because if it's going to be more than, let's say, 12 people around the table from the part of the standard setters, and then the board, the ISB board, it's going to be too massive, and there is a big danger that the communication will be watered down. So, and that is of course the biggest puzzle, how to do that. And you're not, if you're going to make choices there, you're never going to make everybody happy. If you look at current IFES, very useful organization, could that be the basis? Well, on the one hand, it's clearly too big, and on the other hand, it's not inclusive enough because it doesn't. Many standards are not part of this group. and the world standard setters, very inclusive, way too big. So we'll have to find a formula, and I think it should be a formula in which major players, I mean, major players have access to this group, and where there is also, perhaps through a rotational system, where there is also room for smaller countries. The monitoring board is working on such a formula, and we might be able to borrow ideas from that composition. I think we also need to have, probably, the regional groups on board, since they are very inclusive in their region, and they work really well, and they can bring a lot of input to the table. So that's what we're looking at. We only have preliminary ideas at this moment. We are going to talk to a lot of people, and it's going to be a very sensitive problem to solve. We'll try to do it sensitively, but at a certain point, we'll have to take decisions. But I think we should be able to come up with a solution of which most people say, well, this is perhaps not as inclusive as I would like it to be, but I do understand it has to be. It shouldn't be another United Nations in order to be effective. So let's do it this way. To be continued, but we'll be coming up with ideas soon, I think, I hope. We haven't talked to the board yet, we haven't talked to the trustees yet, we haven't talked to anybody yet. I'm saying way too much. Just a few words on the other groups. Users, Norbert said some very interesting things about it. Very paradoxical that the people who you do your work for are so hard to reach. That happened to me as a politician too. You did it for the public interest, but unfortunately the public was not always interested. So we do know we have to reach out ourselves to investors, to users generally. We have been doing a lot in the last couple of years. I'm sure we can do more. And we would be especially interested in developing also more ties, closer ties with true investors. I mean, investors that actually own assets. That's what an investor is, I think. And we'll do our best to get the regions involved. Then preparers, we don't need to encourage them to reach us. They usually know how to find us. They are highly motivated, often have mostly, they're highly motivated, they have the knowledge, and they have resources to lobby. So we have no trouble finding them, they find us. The question is, do we do it in a way which is logistically good? And I think Will made some really good proposals for that. For example, make clear what the membership criteria for the working groups are. And then a lot of useful comments were made about our way of working, our procedures, so as to minimize the chance for non-endorsement. Obviously, the relationship with the standard setters is extremely important for that. But also these ideas about more field testing or better field testing, the idea of a toolkit, and cost-benefit analysis at the beginning of a project, and perhaps at the end take another look at the cost-benefit analysis, is it still there? I think that is useful. Again, I make the same caveat as yesterday. Don't expect full-blown economic analysis quantified of us. I don't think that can really be done. But I think we can make transparent, and preparers can help us with that. How costly is it to implement this standard? Is that one time? Is it recurring? And if it is costly, does it weigh up against, or is the transparency a sufficient reward for that cost? I think that is a reasonable demand, and if we can show that we have done that, I think also the risk of non-endorsement will decrease. Well, I think, and of course, the relationship with the auditors also not one that we really have to work at, in the sense, you know, we see each other every week almost. Mm. Same goes for the regulators, but we really do need sense that we need a much more, a much stronger formal relationship with regulators, and not just the Basel Committee, that too, of course, especially when we're working on financial instruments, but also for our day-to-day work, relationship with the securities regulators is, of course, extremely important. And we talked about that yesterday. We have absolutely no ambition to become an enforcement agency. That's where we have the securities regulators for and other enforcers. But we really feel that we need their feedback, and they probably need ours as well. So we need a strong relationship with them. This is my general remarks. Ian, would you like to? Yeah?
Well, thank you for that, Hans. As you said, this is not over by a long shot, and the infrastructure, both within the ISB and around the world, will continue to evolve. And so I would expect that on an ongoing basis we will have to come back to some of these issues. Later this afternoon, I want to discuss with council members what, if anything, we want to do in light of this topic and other things covered during this meeting. So let's hold our fire on that. No intention of just letting this drop. I think it's more a question of how we make best use of the exchange of views. I do sense, that, as several of the discussion leaders said, you know, when you're asked to provide views, you naturally look to mostly to areas where things could be improved. But all that is clearly in the context of a system that I sense overall people are very supportive of what you're doing. Yeah. And in my sense is a lot of congruence between what we're talking about here and how I understand the strategic direction and the tentative decisions that are being taken as a result of the agenda consultation. So I think there's a message there that can be signaled to the various stakeholders that, you know, there is a game plan and various actions are being taken that support a cohesive package of objectives, which I think is encouraging. We're just about out of time. I don't know what the temperature is down at that end of the room, but I'm not sure how much longer I...
Yesterday we were freezing.
I know. So on average, the temperature's been perfect, but it's like most averages. We have time for only a very brief intervention, because one thing I would like to do is we have two guests with us who aren't with us on a regular basis. I want to give Tricia and Nick just an opportunity if there's anything you want to venture in light of what you've heard. But Saichi?
Thank you. Try to be very quick. Hans, I have a slightly different view about your definition of a true investor or a true user. You defined it as somebody who owns assets. In our jargon, this will translate into the portfolio manager or asset manager, one who really buys and sells the asset. Some of them have no interest in financial statements at all because they are interested in the macro hedges and things like that. And only the small number of portfolio managers who are called bottom-up equity manager, they do read financial statements. But otherwise, portfolio manager, I think, are not necessarily the very good sources to get the input. In my definition, in my feeling, the so-called buy-side and sell-side analyst who look at the particular industry or companies. These are, I think, the best sources. Thank you.
Enough attention to the asset management or companies that do actually own the portfolio as well as the buy side and whatever. But Point taken. Tricia, any observations you'd like to make?
Well, I think it's interesting that people are suggesting that a lot of the consultation, and it's a question of ordering, whether it's first region and then expertise, or expertise and then region, but both of those dimensions are clearly very important in the consultation. But the suggestion that national standard setters are the ones who should be facilitating the sort of the prospecting for those people, and both the expertise and the regional, I think is something that we should probably make sure that we've got appropriately dealt with in the statement of best practice that we'll be discussing at the hopefully the final draft at our meeting in October, because I think that it's clear that the people on the ground in the jurisdictions are the ones that have got to help the most in terms of identifying the right people for the working groups and the various discussions. So I think that's a useful thing for us to make sure that's properly dealt with.
Thanks, Trishan. Nick, last word to you.
Last word. Thank you. Well, it was a privilege for me to be here the last 2 days to see with such a large group and such a lot of talking. And in the meantime, you almost think, well, where are we going? But after 2 days, I see a lot of spirit around the table, a lot of issues with more or less common sense. And so to conclude on that, it's a very good thing to do. And it was very nice for me to be here. The Basel Committee was always supportive of the ISB and all the processes we are in. I made a small contribution of the last 2 days, and well, you can be sure of our support in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, and again, thank you to our presenters and to the discussion leaders. I think for those of you who have joined the Council only recently, one of the most important and also one of the most difficult jobs is to lead these discussions and the report backs, and the challenge now is to make sure that we make best use of the views that have been expressed. All right, to be continued. But next, I think we're ready, Roger, if you are, to see if we are a going concern.
And I'll try not to take my allotted time. If we could go to the next slide, please. The FRC set up a panel chaired by Colin Sharman, who's chairman of one of our insurance companies and also an ex-senior partner at KPMG. And the panel also involved a user and me. And the objective is to make recommendations about lessons learned out of the credit crisis on going concern reporting, particularly in banks. And it was fairly wide-ranging. It was saying, what are the lessons in accounting and auditing, but also in governance? What expectations are there of the directors, for example, in this area? And the final report was only issued last week, so this is very timely. It's fair to say this report contains recommendations which are subject to due process and actually implementing, so we're not final yet. So if you go to the next slide, please. So what were the findings of the Sharman inquiry? I suppose going concern in financial statements is a binary decision, but it's almost impossible for the financial statements not to be prepared on a going concern basis. The company is going to have to be pretty near bankruptcy before it could contemplate any other decision. So it doesn't have much information in it, but quite a lot of people may draw the conclusion that because the accounts are prepared on a going concern basis, that means it's a going concern, and it's almost assured it's a going concern, which clearly isn't the case. Now, there is a requirement under IFRS and auditing standards for disclosures about material uncertainties, and so that would qualify that information. But we found in our inquiry that even in the UK, there's a wide range of views as to just what those requirements mean. And if we think about the difficulty of interpretation in different languages, I think there's even more of a problem. So for a start, there are differences in definitions between accounting and auditing standards. There's very little guidance in accounting standards. There's more guidance in auditing standards, but they vary. And in fact, if you look for a list of criteria which might tell you when a company needed those disclosures, the criteria vary between guidance. So I agree with Arnold's view this morning that there is need for perhaps work on the definitions between auditing and accounting standards, and indeed more guidance about just when a material uncertainty needs to be disclosed. We were talking to various people, even with the UK, who came up with a wide range of thoughts about when that might be necessary. One senior partner in an audit firm thought that if there was a 30% probability of a company going bankrupt, that was when you needed disclosure. If you look at the ESMA guidance, it's a much lower probability than that. Some people may put it higher. And I don't think we can expect the ISB to come up with the definitive conclusion on probabilities. But I think some more guidance there about unified guidance between accounting and auditing about just when those disclosures are necessary will be helpful. Also, we did find that these disclosures have a lack of predictive power. Normally, or most of the time, going concern, emphasis and matter type disclosures do not follow, or not followed by bankruptcy. Similarly, far too often, bankruptcy isn't preceded by those sort of disclosures. So the information isn't really, it doesn't have much predictive power. We also looked at our bank special cases, and I'll come back to that. So moving on to the next slide. So first of all, we felt there was a lack of guidance generally, and we felt that work between the IAASB and the ISB there would be helpful. I think actually guidance longer term might need to wait for a disclosure framework to be agreed. And so I don't think that we're looking for a comprehensive rethink about just what sort of going concern disclosures should be made in financial statements. But possibly IFRIC might be the vehicle for the ISB to actually just look at this particular issue and give a bit more guidance. We did feel also that guidance needs to focus on both liquidity and solvency. At the moment, it focuses purely on liquidity. Broadly speaking, do we have enough cash for the next 12 months, or do we think we can get it? While solvency is also important to a going concern assessment. There's no stress testing in the guidance. That stress testing has become fairly normal for bank assessments now or insurance companies, but it's not necessarily generally adopted outside the financial sector. More importantly, there's no really comprehensive reporting about how do the directors think about going concern risks, how do they mitigate them, and there's little auditor involvement, so there is again an expectation gap. The auditors only really seem to get involved when the company's got real problems and you're into material uncertainties. Before that, they're not. There's certainly no information in the audit opinion, and so therefore there's this expectation gap if a problem appears. So if we go to the next slide. So what were the recommendations? And as I say, these are subject to due process and due course. First of all, I think the main aim of Sharman was to encourage the right behaviours by everybody involved in the financial reporting, the directors and the auditors. I've talked about the definitions for financial statements needing to be harmonised. We think that's a short-term fix. But actually, we thought that a bigger fix was better reporting of going concern risks, probably in the front end of the report. And that's something that we're not expecting the ISB to get involved with, but it's something we in the UK could get involved with. And I think there it's directors warning about going concern risks much earlier when they're much less likely to happen. And that would then actually inform the user about those sort of issues well before they ever became significant risks. And we do feel that assessment should be integrated with their reporting of other risks and with their reporting of strategy. We feel more guidance is needed, certainly in that reporting, about solvency, looking at solvency as well as liquidity, and also stress testing. And although the Sharman panel was comfortable that in an account, in financial statements, assumptions should be neutral, in that stress testing and in that going concern consideration, we thought that directors should be prudent, that they should assume not necessarily that the midpoint would be achieved, but that a fairly prudent point would be achieved, perhaps in realisation of assets. So if we go to the next slide, the recommended process. So I suppose our recommendations are that in the business review, directors should describe the risks, the going concern risks, not just the ones which are material uncertainties, but risks at a far lower probability level. For example, supply chain risks, financing risks, that there are a number of different sort of risks that, that could be to going concern. That the Audit Committee report, and this may be a UK-specific recommendation, but the Audit Committee report should explain the process that the directors have gone through in arriving at that. And then the auditors should comment in their report both on the robustness of the process, that they're happy with the process the directors have gone through, and also whether they're happy that all the risks have been properly reported, or whether there's anything they're going to add, which actually should close the expectation gap. So I think, therefore, the users can draw comfort both from the director's explanation and also from the auditor's comfort on that. And then looking at the next slide, I said I'd come back to banks, which are a special case. I mean, they're a special case because their business model does create particularly acute going concern risks in times of stress, reliant very much on short-term borrowing to finance longer-term lending. And there, the big issue in the last credit crunch was disclosure of central bank support, which was a very politically hot topic. Banks didn't want to disclose that because they felt it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Conversely, users could feel aggrieved if that wasn't disclosed and subsequently a major problem arose. Sharman concluded, and this is perhaps particularly for the UK, that where the company is felt to be, or the bank is felt to be solvent, and that support is expected to be repaid, that no special disclosure is required of that. Conversely, where there are significant doubts about solvency and about the ability to repay that support, then that disclosure was required. Now, again, this is up for consultation. This is after a result of long discussions with the UK Central Bank. It may well have wider application of this, but I'll leave that to the international community. Another issue that Sharman got a lot of lobbying about was actually should banks have a special financial statement or accounting regime? And I think the robust response was no. There's no special accounting regime needed for banks, for example, which ends up with a much more prudent accounting approach than for other industries. But we did feel that certain regulatory reporting for banks is important for users as well. For example, in the UK, there's reporting about variability of level 3 type assets, i.e. what would a 90% confidence level be, or what would a 10% confidence level be. There's other sorts of reporting like that, which perhaps should be better integrated with general financial statements for users. So that's what I want to say about banks. And then going to the last slide. So what are our next steps? We do want to have a dialogue with international bodies, the IASB, the IAASB, about whether we can actually improve definitions. And in fact, I had breakfast with Arnold this morning to start that process off. We will be consulting on changes to UK accounting and auditing standards. And finally, we are looking at UK governance standards to accomplish some of those objectives. So that's my presentation. Happy to take questions.
Thanks, Roger. Open it up, comments? Now, I guess my concern with this is, from a general point of view, is there a risk to financial reporting, to the reputation of the profession or whatever? But a few years from now, lots of companies do end up being less than a going concern. And there are unrealistic expectations. Obviously, that's what we're trying to avoid. Roger, I guess. So I'm looking to you. You heard Arnold and Dan this morning. You're obviously liaising with them. Do you think the risk, in light of what you've just reported, do we have a game plan that's going to contain that risk, reduce it to an acceptable level, or where's your comfort level on this?
I think it's hard to get away from unrealistic expectations if we're only reporting material uncertainties. And I think it's actually reporting those risks which are less than material uncertainties, which might help to close that gap. Because then users are told about some of those issues in a broader sense, well before they might actually materialize into material uncertainties.
Other comments, reactions? Sorry, Jim. Clearly means I finally spotted you, Jim.
In his comments there, Roger made suggestions that the reporters and the Sharman report seem to think that this is an issue that needs to be addressed from the accounting standards point of view and the definition of going concern, and a suggestion that it might be a subject that IFRIC might consider. And I, speaking with my hat on both from this side of the table and where Arnold was sitting this morning, we think that's also appropriate, and I just wonder whether there's any reaction from the other members of this council as to that idea, so that perhaps we can take forward a more broadly based support than just two individual members of council seeking that course of action.
Right, any reactions to that? Do you think it's amenable to, I guess, and Jim, that would be my question. I wouldn't disagree with the value of a more robust definition. My immediate reaction is the one that they've got from memory is pretty clear. Unfortunately, it just sets the bar such that it's a pretty easy test to pass in terms of concluding that you're a going concern. So would we be asking the IFRIC to essentially modify the definition substantially to move that cut?
Through you, Mr. Chairman, if I can respond, I don't know that we know the answer. I think what we need is to get it on someone's agenda who will consciously say, is there a solution, short or long term?
Can I comment? I mean, IFRIC's role is more one of interpretation. So if you're looking for a change or a different bar, then IFRIC wouldn't be the suitable body. If you're looking for an explanation of what those words mean, then it would be the suitable body. So I guess you have to think about that. And it's always nice if you take these questions if you have at least a suggested answer. I mean, it's very hard to just say this is a terribly difficult problem. We've got no idea what the answers are, but could you give it consideration?
Judith?
I think my comment was going to be, Ian, really exactly what you say is the history of this. There's been a lot of academic research that I'm aware of, and I'm sure there's an enormous amount I'm not aware of, into what constitutes a going concern for a company and how you can pick up early warning signs that it might not be a going concern, all of which would lead you to a more precise definition of going concern. I can't see this being on an IASB agenda other than as a, let's look at the research and see whether there's something useful to do here. It just doesn't seem like something that's going to go anywhere otherwise.
And my instinct would be, I agree with Ian's analysis in terms of the prospects of IFRIC being able to move the bar in any appreciable direction based on the words that are in the standard at the moment. I don't think there's a whole lot of diversity in practice in how they're being interpreted and applied. But having said that, I do think that the risk to us collectively, if we continue running around calling things going concerns, which takes on a connotation when the vast majority of people would be puzzled by our optimism, I think we are running a serious risk of an expectations gap crystallizing, and I would rate that risk pretty high. So in that sense, I personally would support somebody doing something. I don't think we can just duck it and say this is an auditing problem. It clearly relates to financial reporting standards. So whether it's the interpretations committee or whether we need some mechanism, they might be a good body to just float some ideas to see if there's any. As we were talking earlier, you don't want to start a project if you don't have some confidence that you could come up with a better mousetrap. So sorry, is that Andrew? Or?
It is, thank you. I think Roger mentioned that one of the ideas was that looking at going concern would be
not just for the ISB, but also for the IEESB. And just as with any project in materiality, where that has come to the fore and there are questions over what's material and what is it, what isn't, I think it's essential that the two boards are working together so that there's consistency in both the auditing and the accounting standards, so that you don't end up with conflicts where you end up with auditing tripping over accounting or vice versa. In terms of the involvement in the interpretations committee, I'm not sure that's the group to do it, because it doesn't feel to me as if there's something in existing IFRS to be interpreted. There is perhaps something where enhanced guidance needs to be developed at board level in conjunction with the IEESB.
Anne, sorry.
Could I just say, in the spirit of all that, both your comments and Andrew's and others, Judith's, we're very happy, obviously, to talk to Roger about this, and we are working regularly with the IEESB, so, you know, together we've got to find a way through.
Anne.
I think I see this issue as part of a bigger picture of the role of prudence in governance, and from prudence, risk oversight, risk management, and then down to the one specific one of going concern. I do feel if you're going to be working with the IASB and the IAASB, you need some director, board, governance input. Because fundamentally, I think that's where this issue is lying, and it's not necessarily in improvement in a standard, but rather more guidance to boards.
I have John and then Carlson.
Well, I think agreeing with some of that, that this is not about defining what a going concern is, because wherever you set the bar, people will misunderstand it when something fails, with the benefit of hindsight. This is inextricably linked to better reporting of business model risks, which is, I think, implicit in what Sharman said. And therefore, in terms of guidance, it's more around guidance around the steps that preparers and auditors need to do in forming their conclusion, rather than saying the bar is in a different place to where it used to be. And there is a lot of other work going on in various forum around the reporting of business risks, etc., that this needs to be linked to.
John. Carlson.
I just want to make the point that if we bring the going concern threshold too low and auditors are required to report on it, being auditors and bearing in mind the litigation implication, we're going to be very prudent in what we say. And the risk is that it might become either too alarming or everybody say something that it become perhaps dilute the effect, becomes not so helpful. So that's something we need to watch. It doesn't go, the pendulum swing the other way. So I think that perhaps is something we should watch.
Thank you. Benoit.
I'm wondering if I'm wrong that this is one of the issues where semantics is involved, because probably my French is limited, but in France, it seems to be that going concern is not really translated the way we understand it in English. I don't know for some other languages. So I think really this concept has to be analyzed, fixed, defined, and even if it's an audit concept, we might even help the auditors in giving more light, because after these research and definitions, audit programs may be much more clear about what elements have to be considered when you have to talk in terms of going concern or not. Because even if actually in audit we talking about some elements like liquidity or enterprise, the entity is having such or such difficulties, I think the concept as such doesn't seem to be really fixed and analyzed even for the auditors. Thank you.
Thanks, Manuel. Last point to Leo.
Wow, for the last words. I was just going to say the other issue with scope, sort of lowering the bar of going concern, is that you sort of, once you don't use that assumption anymore, you fall off a cliff under IFRS. There's nothing, there's no guidance. So if you bring this to the board, the next question is going to be, okay, great, to now that we're clear on when we fall off the cliff, but what then? So prepare what you wish for.
And I believe the FASB have a project on that very point. Roger, any concluding comments?
Just a couple of brief, very brief comments. I don't think there's any diversity of practice on using going concern in financial statements. It's very hard not to use going concern, but I think there is a lot of diversity in practice about reporting material uncertainties. And I'll just read you out briefly the accounting standard, which has neither the intention nor the need to liquidate or curtail material the scale of its operations, and the auditing standard, which says the entity will be able to realise its assets and discharge its liabilities in the normal course of business. So, I mean, those can be interpreted in very different ways, and I think are. So I do feel that work needs to go on the definitions, at least reporting material uncertainties, and it may be if it could do a short-term fix on that, maybe it means a project between the ISB and the IAASB. And the other thing is I agree that we need to watch auditors going for over-reporting of risks. But then at the moment, I think the expectation gap goes the other way and auditors aren't involved at all. So perhaps we should experiment a bit in auditors being able allowed to get more involved in some of those risks, and hopefully better reporting will materialize.
Thank you, Roger. So I guess in the main takeaway that I've got at the moment is perhaps there's some room to provide guidance within the current disclosure requirements as to what would be appropriate disclosures relating to material uncertainties. Food for thought. Thank you for that. All right. The last remaining item is to just, I want to touch base with you as in terms of having been through 2 days of interesting discussions. What actions do we want going forward? There are three items that we spent a fair bit of time on. One is the due process handbook and related breakout sessions that we had, which produced some interesting suggestions. My sense would be that the most appropriate next step for us is maybe perhaps to do what Jan did with respect to our disclosure discussion, which was to work with the discussion leaders, capture the main points arising from the report backs, not attempt to take it further in terms of consensus of council or whatnot, but to we can post that on our private website to give you the opportunity to make sure that it's consistent with your recollections, and then share that with the board would be my sense of, rather than trying to apply too much of a filter to it. And having done that, we can then get a reaction from Ian, Hans, and others, and come back in October to see if, in fact, there's anything more that council wants to do or not. So I just pause. Is that an acceptable game plan for that particular item? Yes, Francois.
Yes, Paul, I think it's a very good way forward. But I think there should be an introduction to these reports stating that the groups have provided input in the context of the questions that were raised, so that the board may be not surprised by having other comments coming in.
I think that's an excellent idea, that perhaps we need a bit of a template to tee up that what the context in which the points are made, which does very much frame the conversation if we stick to the questions, which sometimes we don't always do. And also it might be appropriate to put a bit of a disclaimer in that, you know, we did not attempt to test consensus with the group as a whole, which is different with the disclosure discussion. We did at the end, as is reflected in Jan's summary, there were several important points where the council did reach consensus, and we captured those. So thank you for that. So I see nods of agreement on that account. Second item that's been a continuing point of discussion is the ISB agenda consultation. There, I think the overall reaction was positive in terms of feeling that it was an excellent analysis of the various outreach and feedback that had been received, and I think an acceptance that the main points were reflected in the proposals. We're a little behind schedule. I think at one point we thought that at this meeting we might be discussing project proposals or something that's a little more specific in terms of what the next wave of agenda items might be. My suggestion is that we push that to the agenda committee to see if, in fact, there is a useful allocation of time for that sort of a discussion in October or not. But I really can't think of your advice, I can't think of another step, which I think really puts it back into the normal process that before a major project is activated, the council will be consulted.
I think that's right, Paul. The ball's in our court at the moment. Yeah. And it's not a pressing need in that the ward's quite busy. It's got its hands full at the moment. So we don't need to make agenda decisions overnight. We can do them in a considered way. But we do have a process, and we'll come back with that process as we start getting into decision making.
All right, is that fine? The third one I was going to suggest is the session that we had earlier today dealing with external involvement standard setting process. Again, the report backs, I think, were very useful in that perhaps we should go through the same process as a next step. Let's get those points captured to the satisfaction of the discussion leaders, give members an opportunity to see a draft of that. Having done that, share it with the board, the trustees, I would think, and